Hello and welcome to The Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BP Southside, your local site covering the Chicago White Sox for Baseball Prospectus. I am co-editor-in-chief, Nick Schaefer, and I am joined by two very lovely guests tonight, both staff writers. I'm going to start off in Las Vegas, Nevada with Dr. 100 himself, Mark Permiano. How you doing, Mark?
Not too bad, not too bad. It's my Sunday, so it's pretty nice to end the weekend like this.
For clarity in terms of the chronology of the baseball season based on when this is recorded versus when you listen to it, we are recording on Tuesday evening. It's about the, what is it, like the fifth or sixth inning as the White Sox play the Blue Jays. It will probably be different by the time you listen to this. And that other gentleman you heard chiming in was Frank Furke from recording in Brooklyn. How are you?
I'm good.
I'm, as we speak, I think they're in the White Sox just closed it to 6-4. Predictions for the final score that everyone can immediately know this is wrong. I'm going to say the Blue Jays win 9-8.
I'm going to go 7-6 White Sox.
Nice.
I'm going to say 7-5 Jays.
Conservative, Frank. Very conservative. Hates offense. So we are actually have real baseball to talk about. This is our first podcast in the regular season. The White Sox have been sort of sprinkling in fun games every other day based on the built-in day off on day two and then the snow day, I guess, on Monday. Because in Kansas City, I think the forecast was below freezing and for snow. So we only have three complete games to discuss at the moment. First game was the Matt Davidson and Tim Anderson home run barrage where they beat the Royals, which was delightful. And then Sunday, I believe, was a come from behind 4-3 victory again over the Royals. And then last night they blew a game against the Blue Jays. Guys, any impressions from the first few games?
The ball's juiced.
Do you think it's more or less than last year or the same?
Probably.
I mean, I don't think it's more juiced because of the White Sox couple games, but I do think that I think people were suggesting based off the spring that it did look more juiced. I'm just thinking that the 14-7 in the first game where seemingly all the runs were on homers and, you know, the White Sox had six bombs. I like Tim Anderson a lot. I don't feel like two homers in a game is still going to be unusual for him.
He had another one tonight, so he's up to three in less than four games. The thing that, and this is, I haven't checked this, but it feels like there have been a lot more multi-home run games already around the league than you'd expect. That could just be random noise, but Willington Castillo had a multi-homer game, Paul DeJong. I think Harper had another. I mean, there's just been a lot already.
Harper did last night, for sure.
I think Encarnacion did two. Just off the top of my head.
So one of those is inside the park, so.
Yeah, but it was like off the top of the wall. It was an inside the park home run because they thought.
Home run.
What's up?
It was a double misplayed into a home run. It was bad.
Yeah. I mean, it was hilarious, but.
No, it was very fun, but yeah, it was one of those where you're like, ugh.
Did Edwin put up the parrot for the inside the park home run or no? Because he was running too hard?
I don't think he did. That would be.
I think he didn't, and I want to say I read that. He took as long to get around for his inside the parker as like Tyler Naquin or somebody did for a conventional homer.
I guess the parrot's a bird of leisure, especially the invisible kind.
Can we confirm, Mr. Vet?
Yes.
We strive to be.
Don't let the Twitter profile picture confuse you. I am very bad with birds.
Oh, yeah, that's right. What kind of bird is that in your Twitter profile?
That is a cockatoo. Sulfur-crested cockatoo. Her name is Trixie, and she's awesome.
Is she up for adoption?
No, she came to us because, unfortunately, the way you get the majority of large birds like that is the owner passes away.
Oh, yeah, because those birds live like 100 years, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there was one at the Brookfield Zoo that was at least 89 years old when it passed away. But, yeah, they... The family doesn't want it. It winds up with you. So after those 10 days, what wound up happening is one of our admission supervisors adopted it.
Oh,
so now I get regular updates on how Trixie's doing, and I see little videos of her being adorable.
I have a Brookfield Zoo story. A great or great great uncle or something like that of mine worked at the Brookfield Zoo, and you know, this would have been like a long, long time ago, and I think the polar bears used to get fed marshmallows. Like, you could buy marshmallows and like throw them in to feed them, and the bears notice the pattern. Like, people walk up to this guy, they hand him money, he puts it in the cash register, and then I get marshmallows. And once they broke out and immediately smashed the bejesus out of the cash register because they thought that's where the marshmallows came from.
That's like, there's the thing with the dolphins where they get rewarded for each piece of like trash they would bring to the trainers. This was recent, and they would get fish. Well, this one dolphin figured it out and would use the fish as bait, catch seagulls, destroy them, and bring individual pieces of seagull to get more fish, and just keep getting rewarded because the trainers weren't picking up on it, because you don't spend all day at the same tank, and it would just keep bringing them things to be like, look, I found more trash in the tank. Yay, more fish.
That's the zoo equivalent of wishing for more wishes, right?
Yeah, it's brilliant. I can't imagine being mad as the trainer. Once they found that out, I'd just be in complete awe and just ask to not work with that animal anymore. She's like, it's too smart.
Isn't I think James has James Fegan has a is now related to a dolphin trainer of some kind. I need to follow up.
That was
up
a really excellent pause.
I had to think about
between
it.
Between dolphin and trainer.
I was trying to remember if it was a marine biologist. Like, I don't know if she teaches the dolphins or if they just have a mutual respect. You know, it's unclear what the. I don't know what the role is. I really don't. But to your point about the ball being juiced, I read, I think from Jonathan Bernhardt, who is now contributing at The Athletic and, as always, contributing at any number of places. He was discussing how Alex Cobb, who signed very late in the offseason for a shockingly, like, normal contract. I feel like 460 is what, before this winter, would have been very normal for a pitcher like that, unless I'm crazy. Since he signed so late, he had to go to the minors to finish getting ready for the regular season. He couldn't start the season in the majors. But because the minors and the majors use a different ball now, I think the Orioles or Cobb or somebody was requesting that he could use the major league ball down in the in his like preparatory starts. Which, if we're there, it seems like there's... I feel like one or the other has to change. I feel like the minors need to just start using that ball, right?
Yeah, it's very strange that they don't, because why wouldn't you?
I guess because...
And you're not wrong.
It's also very strange that they don't just, like, buy a bunch of apartments rather than making these guys go through weird landlord situations. But they do. I think they're just... My understanding is they're just being cheap on the balls, but... The other thing I read was that
it's
normal to use major league balls for rehab assignments, but since he's not technically on a rehab assignment because he's not on the DL, that he still has options, and so they just optioned him to double A. I think there was another bureaucratic hiccup because of that.
Oh my God.
The minor leaguers.
It seemed like an incredibly Orioles story.
The minor leaguers being forced to live with host families did give me one of my favorite like minor league anecdotes, where Miguel Tejada learned English by watching like Sesame Street with his host family's children.
Aww.
So like that's how he learned English, and I always thought that was kind of cool, minus the fact that, you know, he's living in poverty in someone's house that he doesn't know.
Yeah. I think I was at a wedding of some law school friends, and a buddy of mine lived with Pete Cosma when they were in rookie ball together. And he said, because I think Cosma had like a college bonus, and I think once he saw the conditions that some of those guys were living in, that he, you know, sort of contributed some of his money to get them in a better spot, at least better food or something like that. But like, you shouldn't have to, like, these are professionals; they shouldn't have to be living on the largesse of their more well-heeled teammates.
Like, I mean, I get when you're called up for like a cup of coffee in the majors and you wind up just living with a teammate, like when Jordan Danks was just living with John, which made all the sense in the world. But it was just like, yeah, you're going to be up here for a week. Don't get an apartment. Just move into the spare room in my condo.
Well, and obviously, if friends want to live together, and if you want to save money, that's fine. I mean, I know Robert Gesellman lived with Noah Syndergaard and his then girlfriend for a while, and it's like, all right, you know, they're not none of. I mean, those guys are all still on their. Syndergaard's still making the $550,000 a year or whatever it is, but you know, that's still, even in New York City, that's still very comfortable. Like he didn't. I doubt he needed.
Stanton lives with AJ Ramos.
Oh, really?
They're not even the same team, yeah.
Oh, right. They would have been buddies from when they were on the Marlins, who played the Cubs to pretty much a draw.
Yeah, when he wound up getting traded to New York, I was reading it in the SI Baseball preview. Yeah, they lived together, and I thought that was kind of cool. It's like, you know, you're one of the richest people in baseball, Stanton, but if you want a roommate, that's cool too.
Yeah, it's like a social thing, I guess. Is one of you chopping potatoes?
No, that is Maya chewing on a silent squeak toy. I'm going to try to get her to do it further away from the computer.
Now, Maya's always welcome on the podcast. Colin wrote a piece on the site. It was up today about how Wellington Castillo might represent someone who's actually good on both sides of the ball at the catcher position for the White Sox. Last year was the first year he was any good at pitch framing at all by our metrics. He had been ghastly before, and then all of a sudden he became quite good. He did say that he started working with Jose Molina in the offseason, who's obviously probably knows a thing or two about that. And he said he'd never really put in as much of a concerted effort before, and it kind of makes sense that there might be some lag getting to the players in some organizations as on the value of pitch framing and whether it's a real thing, especially given that there are rumors that the White Sox themselves were not, you know, aware of that until a few years ago. So it's only been a few games, those statistics apparently normalize very, very quickly because in a given game, a catcher is going to field, you know, 100 to 200 pitches. So right now he's slightly above average. He's got 0.1 in three games or whatever it is. How are you guys feeling about the win now ad of Wellington Castillo on this team?
I liked it. Catcher it's not a spot where there's something to bring up from the minors right away, because if you believe that Collins can be the catcher, he still does need at least another year down there. So it was one of those where it just made sense where, yeah, the price is right. Why flounder another year away wasting it on, sorry, Omar, but Omar as your primary catcher, whereas now you've got a really nice tandem of Castillo, who's always been at least an average hitter, and you can keep developing Omar, see if he can be more than anything else, and if not, then all right, he's a perfectly cromulent backup.
Yeah, I like Narvaez a lot as a backup. I mean, the position's so weak across the majors that in terms of guys who can both hit and defend the position at the new level that's required of it, you know, 10 years ago, Narvaez might have even been considered like a very good starter just because he can get on base at a high clip when there was less power in the league and things like that. But, I mean, it's just so much more, cromulent, as you said, to have him as a backup than, I mean, if Castillo's framing improvements are real and he can hold on to them, then he's, I don't know, one of the, 8 to 10 best catchers in the majors?
It's been a while since we've had something like that.
Is that going too far, Frank? You're the voice of reason usually. Like what, you know?
I mean, I was happy when they signed him. I didn't think it was necessary. I thought it might have made, you know, if we're talking about the positions in which they had multiple options that weren't great, and you wouldn't have minded slotting a vet in, I might have gone with center field instead. But I thought it was, you know, I thought it made sense at the time. I think it does leave you in the odd position of having a potentially, you know, strong player, and then they had two guys who both rated out as sort of like not good enough to be starters, but good enough to be anybody would be happy with them as their backups. And so then it's like, what are you going to do with Smith and Narvaez? Which I think James Fegan's written about this a few times, is, you know, they sort of have to think about it as not they're trying to be the White Sox catcher, but there's 60 catching spots and they're trying to take one of them. And they sort of all got to, you know, that applies to Zavala and to Collins and to Narvaez and to Smith. And they're just, so I thought it was a little bit odd for that reason. Obviously, it doesn't hurt to have an extra catcher, and given how many injuries the Sox have had at catcher the last 2 years. It's also a little bit hard to hear, like, unexpected framing improvement and pretty good offense and not just go back to being really irritable about Tyler Flowers.
Yeah, I've been meaning to write this piece about how, looking back at the 2016 White Sox in particular and thinking, you know, if this market, you know, this offseason market had been available for that team, you know, heading the 15 to 16 offseason, like, that team could have made the playoffs pretty comfortably because, you know, if their needs were like DH and left field and, you know, or like a corner outfield spot and some mid to back rotation depth, like, that was all just sitting there to be had. Like, it was just freely available in this winter as opposed to that winter.
Well, it's also what does that team look like with 2017 Avisaíl and, you know, Tyler Flowers from 16 or 17, I think.
For sure. I mean, even if they just kept Flowers instead of Navarro, I mean, that's such a huge swing. I mean, Castillo, what's interesting to me is it's a 2-year deal, and obviously catchers can get old really quickly, but there aren't a ton of trades with catchers, but the Lucroy trade, which brought back so much to Milwaukee, makes me wonder if that market is still healthier than, say, you know, the rental first baseman, right fielder, or whatever it is at the deadline, where that market just died. I mean, JD Martinez was given away for free. And maybe that was maybe that was an outlier deal. Maybe the Tigers, for whatever reason, just like loved those dudes that they got from Arizona. But that's a pretty extreme example where you have, as you know, as impact a pure bat as you're going to find on the trade market. And getting, were any of those guys even like top 150 dudes? I don't think they were. But regardless, I mean, you've got a 2-year deal, and this is a team where I don't think it's crazy, depending on what they do, to think the White Sox could push for the playoffs in 2019, depending on how things go. But if not, Castillo, if he holds his gains on the defensive side, could be another attractive person to flip at the deadline.
He's a nice one where it gives you versatility either way. I agree with you completely there because, yeah, it's not unreasonable to think that if they actually add a free agent or two next year, they're right there in the wild card hunt, if not a dark horse for just taking the AL Central as is. But then, yeah, if things don't go well, this season winds up being an under 70 win season, and you're just kind of like, hey, you know what? Next year's not going to be the first year of the grand White Sox window. You could potentially flip him to a contender.
Yeah. It is kind of silly to, at first blush, you might say, you know, the White Sox can't challenge the Indians. And obviously 2017, that's certainly not happening. But, I was listening to Tino and Ben Carsley and Craig Goldstein. They were talking about how even though this Cleveland team is really, really good, that it's kind of top heavy and shallow. Like there isn't a ton of depth there. So I wonder if, for all that they have a vice grip on the division now, I wonder how long that's necessarily going to go on for.
I don't think it's going to be terribly long. I would say it's going to be like it was in the 2000s where it's the White Sox and the Twins duking it out.
Well, Cleveland in the 2000s also won the division a couple times, but, you know, 07, I think they went to the LCS. But, yeah, I mean, Lindor and Ramirez are young and amazing. And I guess depending on what you think of Mejia and, maybe Tristan McKenzie and some of those other guys, they might have a...
It's a very top-heavy farm system.
It is, and obviously...
There's nothing wrong with that if those players actually, you know, do what they're supposed to. But yeah.
But I think Brantley's a free agent this winter, and Edwin Encarnacion's getting up there, and even the rotation, you know, I think, like, I mean, Kluber's older than you'd think from, you know, when he arrived, because I think he was a late bloomer.
He was a very late bloomer, I think.
His breakout was at his age 28 season, so he's already in his age 32 season.
Gross.
Yeah, ancient.
I'm still under 30. I can still say this.
Oh, wait. Under 30?
Yeah.
When's your birthday?
June 4th. Then I'll be 30.
Oh, it's my dad's birthday. He'll be older than 30.
I hope so.
We got like a looper situation going on.
Yeah, but he likes
my thoughts on the windows is that, like, it seems largely foolish, and this may have changed in the last few years, but to try to guess at how good a given division is going to be more than a year or two down the road. If you just think about teams that right now, you know, it was what, 2015, the White Sox and the Padres were going for it, and they're both, you know, year two into the rebuild. And so I'm always a little bit gun shy of anything that involves guessing at what the division is going to look like more than a year and a half from now.
Totally.
Fair.
I know that's
get hurt, right? If you think about a guy like Jose Ramirez,
that was exactly, you know, what I was going to bring up on that point. Yeah.
I do just worry, though, like, you look at Cleveland's rotation, and looking at that, just you go, okay, 2 years from now, Kluber, 34, Carrasco, 33, Bauer, 29. It's just like, oh.
Well, the other...
Obviously, things
you don't also, but you don't even... But even with that, like, regardless of which way you want to take that, what did the Mets rotation look like 2 years ago?
True.
Well, and the other thing, yeah, I mean, Jose Ramirez is a great example, but even Lindor, you know, this is, you know, the 95th percentile of his development, right? I mean, he was someone who was like, oh yeah, he can handle short, he looks great there, but, you know, is the power going to come? How much contact is he going to, and it obviously that worked out tremendously. And so you have breakout guys, you have free agent signings that I don't think anybody handicapped the Diamondbacks to sign Zach Greinke, for example. You know, everyone, you can go where the logic makes you think the most likely outcome is going to be, but that it doesn't, you know, the 80% likely outcome doesn't occur for every event across the board, right? Like, so you're right, Frank. It's really hard to predict. I mean, you can't predict baseball, as they say. It's not allowed. It's against the law. Is there anything that's happened? I'm going to start this with the White Sox, and then I'll expand it. Is there anything that's happened in this first 2% of the season or whatever that has happened with the White Sox that has made you revise your expectations for the season, even in the slightest bit?
No.
Nothing?
I mean, Davidson having the three-dinger game was pretty entertaining, but just because the amount of flack I can give certain people for saying, oh, they should have just cut him over the offseason, which honestly is not an unreasonable position, but it was just really fun that the first game of the season he was just like, no, you will never cut me.
When he's already worth, what is it, he's already worth half a win off that one game or something. Yeah. I think...
Well, Lopez's velocity is a bit up from expected, right?
Lopez was the one I was going to... Lopez and...
Oh, Giolito, yeah.
Lopez, I mean, Giolito doesn't really... I was a little bit more guarded on him just because it doesn't... He basically looked like he did last year, right?
We've made the Gavin Floyd comparison so many times that it feels cliched at this point. But honestly, I'm just going to start anticipating him as 08 Floyd, where it's just like there's games where you're watching and you're just furious about how bad of a job he's doing. But then there's going to be that game where it just clicks. And it was like with Floyd, it was a game in New York, and he struck out Giambi on like a 3-2 count by throwing three consecutive curveballs at the knees. And he just was like, nope, you're going to destroy my fastball. I'm not giving you it. And that was the moment he turned the corner and it went, yep, he gets it now.
And I think it's not crazy to have, you know, if you've got a guy who's very curveball dependent, if that's a pitch that sort of might be harder to retain from start to start, unless you're a guy like Quintana who can, you know, if his curveball's not there, you have this insane fastball command and like pitchability and poise. And, you know, you're left-handed, that doesn't hurt. You know, Giolito doesn't have those things to the degree Quintana does, at least. So if his curveball is not there, it might be disproportionately aesthetically displeasing, like his first start was. No, I was going to say Lopez. It was one start, but I found it very encouraging because I always liked his change. I think it always flashed really well, and I thought it looked really good. In his first start last night against what I think the Blue Jays have a decent lineup. We're at that part. I still have one fantasy draft left to go, and I'm like, oh, Jake Junis had a great start, and Trevor Williams had an amazing start. Maybe I should look at, and it's like, oh, they both started against the Tigers. Okay, maybe I should pump the brakes here. I think, you know, it's one start for each of them. But I think it's hard to not be encouraged by what Lopez did last night. I think it's cool that Moncada's leading off. I had someone in my mentions saying Moncada's going to be bad. He's going to be a 230 hitter. Last year he was a 230 hitter, and he was worth like a win and a half over like a third of a season. So even if he is only a 230 hitter, he's still an above average player, which is also interesting, albeit disappointing. Other than that, if Tim Anderson, you know, Frank says, you know, attributes all of it to the juice ball. Frank hates Tim Anderson. He thinks he's bad, but,
you know, you'd think Frank would be the one blocked by him on Twitter.
Yeah, no. The only thing I could think of was the anti-hero headline. It's the only thing I could think of. You know, if we kind of gave him a mulligan on last year, at least Colin and I have. I don't know if you two did.
Oh, I think everybody did. I don't know of any sites or sources, even outside ones that bring it up, like the article on The Ringer yesterday, were at least smart enough to go, yeah, last year might have been one of those things where, hey, pretty serious off-the-field stuff definitely can't affect you, and it's kind of nice that we've reached that point where people are more accepting of it and go, yeah, it scans, as opposed to think back to probably the mid-2000s. If you'd heard like, oh, well, this baseball player is saying he's having a hard time because a friend died, it didn't seem like back then that's something everyone would have been as accepting and understanding of.
Yeah, or yeah, they would have said, well, I can't quantify that, therefore it doesn't exist.
It's kind of nice seeing the shift of the pendulum back towards like, yeah, these numbers are great and all, but these are people.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe it's facile, but I was watching the Mariners this afternoon, and is Gene Segura a comp there, both in terms of his skill set and in terms of that arc? Because Segura was a... I know Kevin Goldstein loved him as a prospect back in the day. I think he was a high-end prospect, and he had a really terrible personal tragedy, and he had some really down years as a result. I mean, Frank, baseball's hard enough that you don't need a reason to do poorly, but he's certainly started to look more like his prospect projection over the last couple of years. So... And I think it's a similar skill set to Anderson's, frankly.
I could remember Segura had been traded for Zach Greinke, but I absolutely did not remember that Greinke pitched for the Angels.
Oh, I forgot that too. I blocked that out.
9 innings that don't exist in my mind. I was like, wait, what?
I think if we all agree, we can all just agree that that didn't happen and erase
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that doesn't sound real. That's the Mandela effect right there.
Okay.
My thoughts on the Tim Anderson sort of discourse, I guess, is that it's one of those ones where what everyone would like to believe is also a pretty reasonable thing. And so, you know, I think people, it's easy, I think, for me to think, well, it's very easy for people to say that it was because of what happened to him. And I think there's a very good chance that it was. And so I think it's to me, it seems, I don't want to be, I hate when people use the term groupthink, so I won't. But it's one of those ones where, you know, it didn't matter that he was bad last year to the team, and he's signed, and everyone wants him to be good, and there's a reason to believe he can do better, because some of it seemed like bad luck, and some of it was obviously the horrible events. And so, for everyone involved, it's just a lot more pleasant if we just keep going.
Yeah, and you know, as Jeff Paternostra would say, if Anderson was going to bust, that's what it was going to look like. And it might even just be a side effect of his profile, right? Like, this is a guy who doesn't have tremendous plate discipline, and he's going to rely a lot on putting the ball in play and trying to, you know, he's going to be a batting average driven profile, and that's a little bit more volatile than a plate discipline driven profile. So that sometimes you just have years like that with those batting average dependent guys. So, I mean, that obviously doesn't cover the defensive side of the ball. Where, and what's frustrating about Anderson is, you know, you look at him and you look at some of the plays he's capable of making. So when he is defending poorly, it's frustrating, right? Like, you think, like, ah, he's capable of better than that. So we shall see.
We've rightly gone away from thinking about things in terms of errors on the defensive side. And I think Anderson is, you know, maybe the exception, where I feel like errors do tell a fair bit of the story, where it does seem like, you know, the concern with him is not the range or the quality of the arm. It's the ability to execute with those tools.
Yep.
And some of that is, you know, at some point we'll stop being able to say that he's, you know, inexperienced for his age, but I don't think we've totally run out of that yet. So.
Well, his OPS is a Bonzian 1438 at the moment. So all is well. Any changes to your season-long predictions after the first week, non-White Sox category?
It's way harder. I mean, we joked about, before coming on, the Phillies.
Yeah.
Because Kapler just seems way in over his head. It's only been a couple games, but something's got to give with this whole, hey, let's hire guys who aren't quite ready for this yet and have them learn on the job kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, Jared Seidler pointed out that the Dodgers front office were like big Kapler boosters, but then when they had a managerial opening, they didn't hire him, which,
yeah,
you know, it's like, you know, Roberts is great, but, you know, if you guys really thought Kapler was the best, then you would have hired him.
Well, it's kind of like Davey Martinez and Joey Cora, where it seemed every offseason, it's like, yep, this guy's getting interviewed for managerial jobs, and just kept getting passed over, and you kind of start wondering what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Though, does MLB have a formal version of the Rooney Rule?
I don't think there's an official one.
I don't know.
Because with respect to guys who get interviewed a lot and don't eventually get hired, some of that is probably that, you know, it's some of those guys, like Kapler, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, it's because they piss off the interviewers. But there is some of that where some of these people clearly, like, the owner has a guy they want to hire and they want to bring some people in so that it looks a little better. And so for somebody like Davey Martinez, without making a strong statement one way or another, it wouldn't surprise me if he was getting a little bit of the, like, we're going to bring him in to do our diligence even if nobody loves him.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is not a reflection. Like, if you fail that interview, it's not a reflection on you.
I agree. I mean, some of it too is, you know, if your relievers come in and get shelled, you always look terrible. But the pitching staff might be, I mean, especially with Neshek and Hunter out and Arrieta not going yet, that pitching staff looks like a whole lot worse. And clearly that's going to change. Like, those dudes should be available sooner rather than later. So, but, you know, after that first series, I was like, oh man, I may have been way too optimistic on the Phillies. I'm wondering how much longer Velasquez gets run in the rotation. I know it's tempting, but I just don't see him being both good and healthy at the same time as a starter. It just doesn't seem plausible. I think the Tigers and Royals are just as bad as I was expecting.
I was shocked the Tigers had, at multiple casinos out here, the over-under line was 68.5. And that just seemed way too high for what that team is going to be this year.
I guess they have what, I mean, depending on what you how far Miguel Cabrera is going to bounce back, if at all. Castellanos, some people still like. Candelario seems okay. But yeah, I mean, I like Iglesias still, but it's rough. Like, they're both, it's like the bullpen's still like as bad as, like, as it always was. It's still hilarious, and the rest of the team is now like that bullpen level. So
Castellanos is a fine hitter, but he just can't do anything else.
Yeah, and he's a
young Carlos Lee, but without the ability to steal bases.
And he's not as good of a hitter as Carlos Lee.
Yeah, or it's just
their staff is
complimentary piece, but you cannot be the guy.
I thought Daniel Norris would have taken a step forward by now. I guess he still could.
I should stop.
Are you the one who lives in a van?
Yeah.
Did we just do the same thing at the same time? That was great.
I think... All right, here's my... And again, this guy, I watched him play against the Pirates. The Tigers. So maybe I need to revise my expectations. I loved Gregory Polanco heading into last year. And then he kept having like hamstring issues and not playing great. I'm all aboard the Gregory Polanco train again. Like, I am full speed ahead. That dude's gonna, I don't know, that guy's gonna be an all-star. I'm a big fan. I suppose, I don't know if you guys have anyone else like that, but he's my guy for this year, non-White Sox division. Any teams that you thought would be any? Do you guys have any similar teams to the Phillies where you were like kind of optimistic, and then they, once you actually saw them in action, you, not even necessarily stumble, but like there's something about the seeing it in action where you kind of think more about, oh, their middle relief really is garbage, or man, this lineup's not as deep as I thought, because you do see. It's like, oh yeah, the bottom half of this really is a mess. Anything like that for you guys or no?
Texas.
Ooh, good pick.
That's when Colin was asking us to help him with that wins pool he was doing, and he had to pick between what, Seattle, Texas, Atlanta, and Toronto. And it was just like, well, Seattle's the clear one out of that, and Atlanta's the clear no, but
and Toronto's definitely better than Texas.
Yeah, but it's just you look and you're just kind of like, man, how is Shinsu Chu still playing?
He's still under contract for a while, right?
I think he might have like 2 years left. Yeah, through 2020.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, if Cole Hamels is really like finally started to collapse, then that rotation is. Could be just egregiously bad.
Yeah.
I didn't get a chance to watch much. 45-year-old
Bartolo Colon is one of your starting pitchers.
Yep. And then Mike Minor trying to start again. Doug Fister is still in the majors. Matt Moore is still a thing.
That is a bad pitching staff. That's like early to mid-2000s Texas bad.
I bumped... I was going to do the default Rangers 4, A's 5 in that division for our predictions, and then I actually looked and I flipped them. I think the A's are a step above them. Like, I felt pretty decent about it. I think Manaea and Graveman are better than, I mean, maybe Hamels still, but...
I mean, the A's definitely have more upside, at least.
I mean, I like Chapman. Olsen seems fine. Semien is still, like, solid. Chris Davis. I don't know. I like the Piscotty ad for them.
Yeah. You look at Texas has a couple of young hitters that it's you can get excited about the future, like Mazzara.
Gallo is still fun. Gallo
is, with that power and his abilities to at least draw walks, he's going to be fun to watch. But, man, that is... How is Elvis Andrus not 30 yet?
He keeps getting better, too.
Just like Green and Oder is only 24? It's like we've been hearing about you for a decade.
Well, you've been hearing twice as much about Rougned Odor, so.
Oh yeah. But you don't really want to be hearing about the other one as much as you have.
Yeah, I haven't heard about him since the thing that I definitely didn't want to hear about him.
So. Do you guys
Ohtani exists and had a pretty good, you know, if we're talking about being happy about a game of Ronaldo Lopez, Ohtani had a very good game.
I'm pretty excited that he signed with the Angels because that's the one California team that we actually get in our cable package.
you get the Angels and not the Dodgers?
Nope, do not get the Dodgers.
Is that because of their fight with the cable company or because of Las Vegas?
Exactly because of their fight. So with the MLB.TV blackout making me unable to watch every California team and the Diamondbacks, I at least do get the Angels on TV. So when I get home from work and go to the gym after work, the Angels games are on. It's just like, all right, this is kind of nice.
I mean, they were my random I'm picking them to sign him thing, so I'm just going to victory lap on that every time, every chance I get. And obviously it would be nice to see, like, Trout not totally wasted for his career. Skaggs had a nice start too. I mean, it's I don't know if is Haney's not still on the Angels, but there was a while where the Angels were collecting all these blue chip arms and they were all just like falling into threshers and stuff, just like not they were all getting hurt. Skaggs once upon a time was pretty highly regarded, so it wouldn't be crazy to see like Skaggs, Ohtani, and Richards put together like a better rotation than you think. I mean, it's just they're paper thin. They're absolutely paper thin.
Is Shoemaker still alive?
He's made a start. He went 5 2/3 innings. That means he's healthy enough to throw more than like 50 pitches. So that's, yeah.
The entire rest of that division other than Houston is just such a rattle. Like, people gave the AL Central crap coming into this offseason and into the season about the, like, oh, well, it's two teams that are trying and then three teams that absolutely aren't. All right, well, the West is Houston, who's going to win it again. Seattle, who's trying but can't really do anything. The Angels, who are kind of trying but can't really do anything. And then Oakland and Texas. Like, yeah, the Central has three teams that are in dedicated rebuilds, but the West just has three teams that suck. they're not rebuilding, but it's just they're bad.
I like Seattle's lineup.
I've spent most of my life watching and rooting for a team that you that describes. So
yeah, well, no, very true. But I mean, the majority of our childhoods and until we became adults, the Sox were at least competitive. They didn't suck hard. It was just like, oh well, they're another 84 win year, and it's like, yeah, that's fine. Like, it was entertaining enough. But this year, looking at, like, the Rangers aren't trying to tank, and they're going to be god-awful. They're going to be pretty bad, too.
The White Sox, the score is currently 7-5 Toronto, so Frank's looking pretty good with his prediction for this game. Speaking of teams that are awful, the Minnesota Twins, I got to tell you, once they got rid of the Metrodome and they started adding some fun players, I was starting to finally mellow on my long, long built-up Twins resentment. And then they had to go do what they did. They were...
Sign Lance Lynn.
He looked like garbage the other day. They were playing the Baltimore Orioles, and they were up either 6-0 or 7-0.
Seven.
And Berrios was going for a complete game shutout. He'd only given up a double that game, but he was throwing a one-hitter. There was no hitter or perfect game at stake. And in the ninth inning, I think it was, the Twins put on a big infield shift for Orioles rookie Chance Sisko. And Chance Sisko put down a beautiful bunt for a hit. And the entire Minnesota Twins team lost their minds. Both like Rosario, Berrios, and Dozier all gave quotes saying, like, you don't do that. That's like Bush League. That's not cool. That's the wrong play. We don't have to start something, fortunately, because they have veterans over there who will tell him, like, that he screwed up. And the Orioles promptly were like, I don't know what they're talking about. Like, there was no.
I loved the direct quote of, yeah, we do have veterans, but they would tell him to do what he did.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, what was, did you guys have a particularly favorite aspect? Because Dozier doubled down on the quote today because he was like, oh, what people don't understand is that, because even Twins fans were like, what are you guys talking about? Which is remarkable. Like, credit to Twins fans, because most sports fan bases will, like, bend over backwards to defend whatever happens under in their jersey or under their logo. But this was just sort of, like, unanimously panned. It's like, what are you guys, what, like, to defend the one hitter? Like, what on earth are you talking about?
Well, yeah, because
I like the really elaborate examination of, like, conceding as though this is, like, golf, where you, like, concede a putt in a formal manner, which you do not. I do have to say, I think my favorite thing is that it hadn't occurred to me until you just said it out loud, because I don't think I've ever heard his name said out loud, that his parents probably named him Chance Sisko so that it would rhyme with Francisco. And so now I'm just hoping that there's like a he pairs with, you know, Frankie Rodriguez or something.
But Dozier even said today, he was like, oh, well, the inning before they weren't trying to hold a runner on. So that's an indication to us that everybody's agreed that nobody's trying anymore, which was weird, because if no one's trying, if no one's trying, why are you shifting? And the other thing, too, is
that's what I was talking about, was the like, oh, they're not trying anymore. It's like, well, that's not that viable in general, and it is extremely not viable if you're shifting.
And yeah. And the most, I think something that hasn't gotten raised too is that this is like Sisko's like second or third major league game. I mean, this is the type of thing he should be doing. I mean, if opponents are shifting on him, that means they think it'll hurt his numbers. So do anything you can to make them think twice about it.
Yeah, and you're a rookie. You are, every hit matters incredibly.
Yeah, it's like, what, his like sixth major league at bat or something? So, yeah, I don't think, see why he's supposed to have this deference for Berrios' one hitter, which is not a thing. Pretty hilarious. I like that Dozier doubled down on it so that he could get just like dragged again instead of having it fade into the news cycle. And I'm not going to let it fade either. That's
no, it's going to be August and he's still going to be giving quotes about why Chance Sisko messed up.
Yeah. Well, I it wasn't quite on the level of Cole Hamels drilling rookie Bryce Harper, because I guess he didn't like his Sports Illustrated interview from 5 years before. And then Harper stealing home on him, which was easily the coolest thing I've ever seen. But although Braves fans yelling overrated at him right before he hit a home run yesterday was pretty good, too. So that's where I'm at. I don't know if you guys had anything else to add, but I think we'll tie a bow on it. And did you guys have any notes you want to end on before get on the record now before the White Sox win 95 games this year?
I think I'm okay.
I think that's a good place to end.
Sounds good. We always say we're going to do it in like an hour, and then we run like an hour and a half. So
this time we actually went under an hour.
I know. It's later on a weeknight, so I'm going to have to be old and lame and do that. But thanks for joining me, guys.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, and go Matt Davidson. Bye, everybody.